I'm calling generative AI the operating system of the next generation enterprise. You know, it's going to be a foundational fabric that runs through all of the different ways the next generation enterprise operates. And I think there are multiple classes of benefits to leveraging generative AI. AI became democratized. You know, the access to these vast capabilities and extremely powerful capabilities that were locked in the head of a few experts in different domains has now truly been democratized. A chain of agents is basically a set of LLM-enabled business processes that are able to take work, look at it, do the piece that they think they can do, and hand it off to another LLM application.
Welcome to the Chief AI Officer Podcast, where AI meets leadership. And here is your host, Sanjay Puri.
Welcome to the CAIO Podcast, where we explore the world of enterprise AI leadership through conversations with those at the forefront of artificial intelligence transformation. I'm your host, Sanjay Puri, and today we are joined by Sriram Ramanathan, the Global Chief Technology Officer at Exela Technologies. With over 23 years of experience in mobile, AI, and cloud computing, Sri has an impressive track record that includes roles as engineering CTO of AI product development at Genpact, Group VP of Cloud Platform at Oracle, where he led their AI bots initiatives, and CTO at Kony. He's also been an IBM Distinguished Engineer and Master Inventor with over 150 patents to his name. Currently, he leads a 2,000-member technology team at Exela, focusing on cloud-native architecture, Gen AI integration, and building a world-class product culture. Welcome to the show, Sriram.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here, Sanjay, and it's great to meet you.
Same here, Sriram. Our podcast is global, and the purpose, as I mentioned before, is to really give your peers some lessons learned for them who are listening to you. It also serves as an opportunity to reach out to talent, given the cool things you're doing, because one of our missions is to democratize AI talent, make sure it doesn't all end up in big, Silicon Valley companies, and also inspire others who want to grow up to be you. So with that, Sriram, for people who don't know a little bit about Exela, can you just tell our audience just a little bit briefly about what Exela is?
Sure. Exela is about business process automation and leveraging technology to deliver solutions and services in highly regulated fields like healthcare in the United States, the banking industry in the United States, as well as globally in Europe and Asia as well. We're about $1.5 billion in revenue, and we're traded in the NASDAQ. And we are on a trajectory to put technology at the very core of everything that we do when we deliver our services.
Great. $1.5 billion global, putting technology at the core of everything you do. That's fantastic. And I'm sure our audience is going to learn a lot from you. Sriram, you've been involved with AI throughout your career, but the past 2 years or 24 months have been a little unique. What makes the past 2 years particularly transformative in the AI landscape, according to you?
So that's a great question. No doubt about it. I think November 2022 was kind of an aha moment when, the first LLM shipped via the investments in OpenAI. And I think These large language models and their capabilities have astounded everyone. I think they've transformed the way that we think about the potential of AI. They've also raised a lot of questions, about how AI is being used and governed and all of that. All very important questions that I'm sure we'll get into. But I think the potential for what AI could be leveraged for, and the view of that potential has been very, very different, as a result of the last couple of years. But in my mind, you know, the biggest thing that happened was that I think AI became democratized. You know, the access to these vast capabilities and extremely powerful capabilities that were locked in the head of a few experts in different domains has now truly been democratized, in the sense that anybody, you know, who has $20 a month, you know, can subscribe to you know, world-class access. And if all you do is subscribe to Twitter, you've got access to another amazing LLM that XAI has built. So I think in my mind, the biggest impact has been around the democratization, you know, of the use of AI, so that anybody anywhere in the world at any time has this assistant who's just the smartest entity in the world, you know, and can answer questions on and help you deal with problems, you know, build strategies, you know, run your startup, you know, improve your sales, you know, improve your marketing, improve your personal communications, you know, and help you deal with a lot of things that you simply never ever had a chance of doing before. So I think that's what's been truly transformational over the last 2 years, you know, and I think it's a huge step forward.
I think you make a very important point I think your point is it's democratized AI, because as you kind of alluded, it was generally in research labs, it was in academic institutions, and people generally thought it was, you know, when you look at the Terminator, it was those kinds of things. That was generally the impression of AI. But now, as you said, all you need is maybe just this, and you have an assistant that gives that capability. But you made a point, because I think it is fair to assume, Sriram, that most of the world was pretty stunned by what the potential was. Were you shocked when you tried ChatGPT the first time? Just curious.
Yeah, it's very interesting. So I've been following GPT for a number of years. Mm-hmm. You know, the original GPT models, mm-hmm. and we were using it for very, very simple generative, you know, AI use cases. Things like, you know, generating limited text from unstructured data that was coming in, or being able to do very simple generative tasks. OpenAI is not new. I mean, this company was started, mm-hmm. you know, many years ago. I think Elon Musk started it and he bootstrapped it. And they've been working on these transformer-based models for a number of years. So those of us who are in the industry, you know, we kind of knew that this work was going on, and we'd seen the work that OpenAI had produced prior to, you know, the 3.0 and 3.5 models. We had seen that and we were aware of the potential. But I think there's no doubt that, you know, in November of 2022, when it came out, I don't think anybody was aware of the corpus of data that this thing had been trained on. You know, the size of the data and the number of billions of parameters that went into training this data, and the outcome and output of that was definitely stunning, even for those who were, you know, quite immersed in AI already. So I think it was definitely a seminal moment, I would say. Yeah.
Well, that's interesting to note. As I said, someone who, like you, has spent most of his career in this, so obviously imagine what the rest of the world's kind of looking at. Sriram, you know, at Exela, you're basically integrating Gen AI, from what I understand, across your entire product portfolio. Now, and I talk to chief AI officers and leaders like you, how do you prioritize which products get AI capabilities first, or which use case to pick? Because there's so many use cases of this incredible transformative, you know, technology.
Yeah, no, I agree. I'm calling generative AI the operating system of the next generation enterprise. You know, it's going to be a foundational fabric that runs through all of the different ways the next generation enterprise operates. And I think there are multiple classes of benefits to leveraging generative AI, you know, properly. I think the first one, you know, that most business leaders look at is, you know, can this tech help me make more money, right? And they focus on top line, which is obviously important to them for a variety of reasons. And a lot of the operating folks within the company are looking for benefits around productivity. You know, can I do more with less? Can I do more with what I have already in terms of resources? Can I go all the way and do a lot more with less resources? You know, whatever those resources are, whether they're compute resources or human resources or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And so I think those are, you know, the thought processes that go into the business case behind how you can effectively apply and leverage AI within your enterprise. And so for us, you know, anything that we do at Exela is very much business case driven, because we always operate in a very cash constrained, you know, environment where mm-hmm. we've got a limited number of resources, and we're trying to find the best way to deploy those resources, right? Mm-hmm. At the same time, you know, we want to improve very basic things like service, customer service. That's a big area for us. We see that as fairly low hanging fruit, because you have conversations that are already happening. You know, you have call centers that you're operating that you can optimize. So there's, I think some low hanging fruit that you can go after to realize some value in terms of a business case. So I think the whole service area, you know, is one. And then you've got productivity improvements, you know, across the board that you can look at. And which one do you pick first? And what's the business case associated with that first? So we've got our business leaders deciding, you know, which of these business cases they want us to, you know, initially focus on. And we provide the technology platforms to enable that and take that forward on behalf of them. But I think your point is valid in the sense that it's not a case of, you know, everything for everybody, everywhere, all the time. It's more a case of, hey, let me see where this makes sense, where I can get, you know, the most tactical return on my investment, and where I can, you know, help improve the amount of work that I do, you know, per unit time, you know, help, you know, the human operators I have, you know, make them dramatically more effective or just need less of them. So all of that are part of the equation, Sanjay.
So you made some couple of interesting points, and I hope I remember the two key points that I want for our audience for you to elaborate on. One is, you said you look at Gen AI as the operating system of the future. I think that's a very important statement you made. Now, just recently, again, the news has come that maybe OpenAI is looking at creating a browser, basically so that it kind of keeps you locked into their ecosystem or whatever, you know, a world environment, etc. But for our listeners, what do you mean by the operating system of the future? Just briefly, if you can elaborate.
Absolutely. One of the areas of work that's going on today in the field that Silicon Valley is looking very closely at is this concept of a chain of agents. Mm-hmm. You know, so a chain of agents is basically a set of LLM-enabled business processes that are able to take work, look at it, do the piece that they think they can do, and hand it off to another LLM application. So you've got mm-hmm. chains of LLM applications that at many levels, you know, they augment or replace, you know, a lot of what humans do today. You know, you've got models that you can train to do all of the things that you know, for example, a data entry operator in Excel could do. You know, I look at a screen, I find elements there. You know, I'm able to deal with the visual elements I see on the screen. I'm able to read emails. I'm able to respond to them. I'm able to take content that I get from an email, log into another application, carry out certain actions there, such as reconciling an invoice, for example. So I think you've got a lot of highly repetitive tasks that go on at scale within the context of any enterprise today. Mm-hmm. And I think employing this chain of agent strategy as part of the way that you operate is what we mean when, you know, what I mean when I talk about, you know, the operating system of the next generation enterprise. So I think I do think that we're very much at the beginning stages of this line of thinking. But you can see, you know, this next generation of startups that's going to be built around this technology, you know, low-code tools that allow you to build these agents at scale and make them channel agnostic, be able to, you know, deal with communications, whether it comes over instant message, whether it comes over a browser, whether it comes over a phone call, you know, or whether it comes over an email. All of these channels will be effectively disintermediated and handled by these agents because these are innate capabilities they already have. They're multilingual, they understand voice, you know, they're able to, you know, take structured content out of unstructured input, and they're able to do it at scale. And increasingly, the cost factor, today it's expensive, but I think costs will continue to come down. We should talk about that as well.
Yeah. Just one quick thing in there. Do you visualize also agents working with other agents too in this process?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I visualize a world where you'll have LLM agents talking to one another, software agents, and talking to agents that belong to other enterprises. So you're going to have chains of agents that communicate intra-enterprise and inter-enterprise, you know, between enterprises. So I think all of these will happen, you know, over the next, you know, I want to say in the next 5 years, and it'll transform the way, you know, enterprises operate. And I think it's going to dramatically improve valuations, you know, across all of the different companies. And you've already seen the impact that AI itself has had on the stock market. And I do really believe that we're absolutely just at the tip of the iceberg here, you know.
Well, you make some so interesting points. One other point on this inter-party communication. Do you think, Sriram, in your view, again for our listeners, there's a need for a communication protocol between agents like my agent versus your agent at Exela, which is, you know, is there a need to standardize for privacy security? I mean, do you would see something like that?
You know, I think you're asking a good question. You know, you've got a lot of the, you know, layer 7 up to layer 7 protocol, you know, they're already there. So your transportation infrastructure, you know, your security models, you know, I think we should spend a little bit of time on this because non-repudiation is one of the big problems that we have in the AI space today. You know, given one of the potentially negative aspects of Gen AI is that non-repudiation, which was something that we took for granted, you don't know that what you're saying is in fact what it's claiming to be, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a problem that we'll have to solve with, you know, multi-factor authentication and a number of other things. But I think the core communication protocol as it is today in today's human-based world will continue to be natural language. You know, natural because you have these agents that are able to, you know, understand, you know, the spoken word, they're able to understand the written word, and they're able to do it in a very contextual way. And they were able to do it across cultures, across, you know, across languages, you know, across all of these traditional barriers that we've had. So I think the quality of communication will get better, but I think the overall protocol is going to be, you know, human level communication because these agents, you know, from the ground up, they're designed to, you know, interact and act like humans. They've got that, you know, as a core capability baked right into them. Coming to your point about security, I think this is a whole separate topic, Sanjay, that we should, you know, spend more time on. You know, there's no doubt that there are many different security ramifications that Gen AI will cause us to have to think a lot harder about. But for sure, non-repudiation is out there. It's out there. I mean, you're already seeing content today in social media, and the quality of this content is so high that non-repudiation is becoming harder. You're not able to tell that this content is actually what it's claiming to be, whether you see a video of something or you listen to an audio tape of an audio track of something, you don't know if it was generated or if it was, within double quotes, the real thing. So the lines of distinction between what's real and what's not real, they're unfortunately getting more blurred than we'd like them to be. And I think it's a separate topic we should spend time on. It's no doubt a concern that you're highlighting.
Yeah. Just on that point, I just read recently that LinkedIn says that any long posts, I think over 57 words or something, are generally AI generated. But that, I think that's, a as you said, an important point, and we'll definitely come to that. Sriram, let's talk about the economics of AI deployment. You know, there's always been this, and I've had, guests come in, and we've also, there have been reports about all these massive investments that are going in for, Gen AI deployment, LLM deployment. How do you, and this is also for your peers who are listening, how do you balance the cost of private LLM deployment against the benefits, in your view?
It's a great question. And I think it's a question that we're all in our community going to have to tackle, very soon. So today, there are very few people in the world, who are able to afford the costs of obviously building their own LLMs, and then scaling them to the point where they can be used by millions of people. And you know who the user players are, whether it's OpenAI or whether it's Anthropic or whether it's Google or whether it's Meta and Facebook and obviously Microsoft themselves. They're only, and obviously Apple is at the same scale. There are very few players, and then you have governments. You have state actors like obviously China, maybe the Indian government. Obviously the United States government. They have the resources to throw at a problem like this. Just the compute, and memory, and the footprint that you need to build these models is enormous. I mean, a lot of us, we're used to our 90s and 2000s style data centers. We have no idea what you were talking about, because the power requirements that you need are off the charts. Our United States grid, which I think is one of the most resilient in the world, it cannot even come close to generating the power that we need, to train and sustain these models. They're that power hungry. And you're seeing NVIDIA's, stock, go off the chart, because they're one of the few that produce the compute that drives a lot of this, right? And I think you've got the training side of it, which is obviously, the most intensive piece. I mean, you have to train the model. And then you've got the inferencing side of it, where people use the model. Mm-hmm. And the problem there, again, is that if you took, you had a very good technical team, and you took the open source model that, for example, Facebook, open source, it's called Llama. So you take an instance of Llama and you say, okay, I have this model. I'm going to use it just like any other, piece of open source software. I'm going to get it to run on my Amazon private cloud. Just doing average volume inferencing is going to cost you between $150,000 and $200,000 a month just to get that model to work. So what are the cost economics? How much of it, what size of company are you that you're able to afford your own private LLM that you're hosting and managing within your own namespace, your own private data center, your own private cloud, or your own VPC? It's not many companies in the world that are even capable of doing this, let alone the talent that you need to manage the DevOps around this, the AI ops around this, and all of that. It's a really complex problem. So a lot of companies, they are using these PaaS services. They're using what OpenAI gives them, or Azure gives them, or the Groks of the world give them. And you get billed per token. And the token economics don't add up. If you want to start really, using this, you're not paying by token, and so your costs go up. It's a cost equation. Then to exacerbate the problem, you need policies to make sure you know what you're sharing with these models. You know, because a lot of companies have guardrails around what they want to send to the public cloud. And if I send something to a public model, like an OpenAI model, is my company information being used to improve and train your models? Am I okay with that? You know, maybe I will be, but maybe I'm not. You know, do I need some type of enterprise guarantee? Google very recently, as part of their Gemini implementation within Workspace, they committed to all their enterprise customers that they will not use their enterprise data to train any of these models, you know? And so I think the field is evolving, but I think if you're large enough, you know, you're going to be thinking about your own privately hosted LLMs. I mean, I think the cost will get to a point where you may not need an LLM. You may need a medium language model that's smaller, but does a lot of the work that you care about. And even in some cases, a small language model that requires the amount of compute you need to train and use these things for inference, it really depends on the size of the model. So you may be able to get away with a lot less. And I think these are questions that everybody is still grappling with right now. But the economics matter, I mean, to your point.
So economics matter, Shriram. Some of our listeners are not, you know, companies who can spend the $150,000 a month or $1 million a month or, you know, tens of millions. And they also worry about the security of their data. The question, obviously, what you're saying is there will be medium-sized models. There will be the SLMs, the small-sized models. Any other solution you see? Because, you know, the Moore's law will apply to LLMs also at some point.
Absolutely. So I see, you know, at the highest level, I see sovereign clouds. I see sovereign models. So, for example, the country of India will probably build their own sovereign models that are trained on Indian data, made available for Indian use, geographically limited to India. It's a security question. So, at the highest level, I think you're going to have these sovereign AI clouds, you know, that make sure that because data is protected and the models that are tuned and made for those geographies use data that are the IP in some respects of that sovereign entity. For example, the Modi government could do that. And I have no doubt that the American government will do the same thing. So you've got those. And then at the other end of the spectrum, I think you're going to have a lot of companies that absolutely leverage open source models, you know, especially, you know, models like Facebook, and start hosting them in their own data centers. We've seen that. But I think you're going to have a very large middle, you know, where you have a hybrid world where you've got a combination of models that you have and a combination of larger models that you're using with your partners on the cloud, you know, to drive value for your specific use cases. The other thing that's happening is, you know, what I'm calling model ubiquity, mm-hmm. where you're going to have models that are miniaturized and that are running for inference everywhere. They'll be running on your watch. They'll be running on your phone. They'll be running in your TV. And so you're going to have some level of model ubiquity where you're going to have stripped down models that are super smart. But with compute, as you said, with Moore's law, you're going to see the cost of compute continue to go down. You can argue about how fast that's going to be or whether there's a factor there. The trajectory is clear. Cost of compute is going to continue to come down. The cost of expensive compute that's expensive today, is going to continue to come down. Inferencing is always cheaper. And so the models that you deploy to all of these different form factors, what I'm calling models everywhere, model ubiquity, it's going to be everywhere. And so the amount of compute you need for those models will also be a lot less. And that hardware is going to get commoditized. So you're going to have these agents on these models all over the place, and they'll be collaborating and communicating with larger models going all over the place and delivering you with some amazing use cases. You know, so I see this confusing world with two ends of the spectrum, but most of it is going to be in the middle. You know?
So, sorry, go ahead, Shriram.
No, I was just saying, I think it's a kind of a long-winded answer to what you're asking, Sanjay, but I think you're going to have literally millions and millions and billions of models that are just running all around the place. Some of them are going to be these massive sovereign models. Some of them are going to be models that run on every device you have in your house, right? And they're all going to be interconnected and interoperating with one another over time. You know.
So you said this, so sovereign AI has become a big thing, especially because of geopolitics.
Yes.
And, you know, we can spend a lot of time. I have another podcast, we deal with that.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, you talked about India, China, US, but what about a country like Jamaica, Botswana, or, I mean, I can rattle off maybe 100 countries who have population of 600,000, 1 million, 2 million, and don't have the resources. They can't get left behind, but maybe that's another topic. But what you're saying is there is going to be model ubiquity. That's going to happen. Shriram, you've worked with a lot of highly regulated industries, like you said, you know, banking, healthcare, etc. How, this is for your peers, how do you address privacy concerns when implementing AI solutions?
I mean, this is another huge question. I think it's a very important question, Sanjay, that you're asking, and it's going to how we deal with these issues with privacy is going to determine how widely, you know, some of this technology gets adopted, you know, and many concerns around privacy are real, obviously. And security is another closely related topic. And Exela, we've gone and built our own, you know, model security suite where we'll go test chatbots. We'll go attack chatbots and we'll build guardrails around them so they don't hallucinate and, you know, go and do all kinds of crazy things and say all kinds of things. So we've spent a lot of time, you know, shipping some technology around that. But I think, you know, privacy is a huge area. It's not just about, you know, me being worried about having my private data being used for training. It goes all the way back to the AI life cycle. Where is the data that you're using to train your model coming from? Do you have access to it? Do you have the right guardrails around that data? And, you know, are you keeping that in mind? What are the technologies you're using and techniques you're using to train these models? You know, what are, you know, the processes that you have in place, especially if you're one of the companies that's building these large language models, you know, to safeguard the privacy of not just the data that's used to build these models, but also during inference after you've built and deployed these models, you know, your interactions with consumers who use these models. You know, what are you doing, you know, to safeguard privacy? And I think this is why you've got such limited legislation around it, because it's a complex topic to properly legislate around. You've got Biden's, you know, policy and his executive order around AI. And then you've got the European Union that just recently passed what they're calling their AI European Union law. But they're all focused around the same thing. They're focused to a large extent around privacy and security and how you provide the right guardrails so that you don't suppress the technological development of this technology, which is super important. Yeah. But you're able to grow and get benefit without, you know, privacy issues downstream. You know, so I think it's a very complex topic. And I think each you can look at it from the individual perspective. You can look at it from a company and consumer perspective. And you can certainly look at it from a tech giant perspective, the people actually building these models. You know, so I think each one has a different set of perspectives that they're all bringing to bear to influence any legislation that eventually happens.
Yeah. Well, that's true. It's really, when I talk to chief AI officers, leaders like you, they say it's, you know, one of the things, this governance keeps them up at night. Shriram, can you, for our listeners, your peers, share a specific use case where AI has, you know, significantly transformed a business process at Exela?
Absolutely. For us, it's customer service, you know, for all of our digital properties. You know, we have a product that it's an agentic product that, for example, goes to a website and all of our digital properties as a case in point, as well as our customers, where we'll go and learn all about every piece of information that's on that website, for example, product information, you know, FAQs, you know, contact information, you know, everything that's out there. And we dynamically create a bot. And that becomes self-service for that digital property. You know, you're able to go to the bottom right, you know, and talk to a smart bot that knows, can answer questions. If you're interested in buying that product, you want to understand pricing plans, you want to, you know, you want to sign up for something, you've got, you're already an existing customer, you've got problems in terms of how to use the product, or how you've got specific issues that you need diagnosis, help with. So whatever it is, right? The technology today, it reads all of the content that you give it and it vectorizes it. And then it uses an LLM in the background. And we have a vector database that we use. We use an open source vector database. And so customer service has been a very important and significant use case for us that we've been able to, you know, really, really change the economics around. You know, I still think this should hold true for most of our listeners, you know, because it's a fairly low-hanging, you know, use case where you typically had an agent that was actually responding to a chat. And in most cases, you don't need an agent. But when you do need an agent and you have to transform the interaction, you have to divert it to a human, the human gets all the context, you know, that happened in the digital interaction, and he knows what went wrong or didn't. But to the end user, it's a consistent experience, whether they're talking to a bot or whether you're talking to a human, they get the same quality of experience. And at some point, they don't care that they're not talking to a human because they get what they need to get done and they move on.
Yeah, no, that's, as you said, it's a low-hanging fruit. So let me just make sure I understand and our listeners understand. Is this a product that you can offer to clients also?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's part of our Inventor suite of products and its capability that we can make available to every client. In fact, we're in the process of commercializing this and launching a big campaign around it. But absolutely, yes.
So again, might be asking a simplistic question. Let's just say I'm an e-commerce company and some of our listeners have those. Can your agent, how fast can your agent grab my information and turn this into a intelligent bot on my website? How fast can it do that?
It's hours to days, you know,
wow.
Because a lot of this is automated. You know, so you'll be able to build this capability in very limited amount of time, you know, and wow. One of our R&D, you know, heads, you know, they will be able to, you know, demonstrate that and get that working in no time. Yeah. It shouldn't take much time.
So think about all the small business owners who are sitting there. They are thinking, I need a CRM system. I need these call center agents, this, that.
Oh, yeah.
And this is the power of AI.
That's correct.
You've given, as you said, the democratization, as you said, of AI gives these small businesses access what you have done, which is pretty incredible. Now, let me ask you this as a next step, because there is a reason I'm asking. Do you see that there will be a need for CRM moving into the future? Because you're kind of playing with your bot or maybe other bots. Let's just not put you on the spot. They're kind of replacing the whole CRM workflow. And Klarna, which is this payment firm, said they took out their CRM system and replaced it with AI. Now, anyway, whatever that was. But what do you think of that for your
peers? It's happening. It's totally happening, Sanjay. I think you're 100% correct. It's happening. You know, things kind of creep up on you. You know, they are happening, and then when they reach critical mass, then it explodes. But it's totally. I mean, you're 100% right. I mean, I think you're talking about Klarna, but
yep.
I think this is a trend that's happening everywhere. You know, the customer service. You know, people who maintain. You know, who do the physical role of a CRM. It's the 80-20 rule. You've got an interaction category that takes up most of your effort. You know, these are repeatable interaction categories. And that's the part that you get automated really fast up front. And then you're augmenting the limited number of humans who will be in that space. But a lot of humans, absolutely, this will replace. Yeah.
And some software too.
Absolutely. Yes.
Wow. Well, yeah. For our small business listeners, I think Sriram has given an amazing information and tips. So that's thanks, Sriram, for that. Sriram, we talked briefly touched on security. So let's just go a little bit deeper for our listeners. What security frameworks have you put in place to protect your AI training data and models? And what do you recommend for our listeners to your peers?
Yeah. I think, you know, in our company, security as a set of business processes is an independent entity. You know, you've got security that we think about very early in the life cycle. You know, so we in our business we call that shift left. So shifting left is moving all of your thoughts around security, you know, your technology around security, your processes around security, moving them to the left of our design processes. So we want to think about security from the ground up and not purely just black box based, you know, where you've already shrink wrapped and built something and then you're kind of testing it and hitting it, which you need to do, which is super important. You know, testing a chatbot, for example, you know, black box testing is extremely important. But I think moving the security conversation, you know, for us as a technology provider, shift left is an important thing that we talk about internally in terms of how we can go to our design, to the data that we use to train, where that data is from. You know, is there anything that's remotely even identifiable there? Have we de-identified every possible thing that we can, and an inspection process around that? And then obviously the way that we construct and build our model, and we have this automated pipeline, you know, that we use to scan, you know, everything that we do, to test everything that we do, you know, to assure everything that we do. So we have a fair amount of you know, assurance that a model that's deployed is reasonably secure. And obviously the physical environment, you know, the software environment, the VMs the model runs on, how you protect those. And then observability at runtime. What's going on? You know, what are the different events that are happening that you care about? Because you have millions and millions of events that are happening. Mm-hmm. You know, are you looking at just those events that actually matter to you? And do you have the technology and processes in place to go look at those events? So we have this thing called a SIM. It's a security, you know, bucket where we have millions of events coming in that we store, that we're watching in real time, you know, and trying to figure out which of these matter to us and how to deal with it. And then we've got a pen testing team that looks at the final output. And we have software as well. You know, for example, when we deploy a chatbot, we have software that goes and tests that chatbot. We have a suite of tools that we release that use an LLM, by the way. They use an LLM to learn and go hit this chatbot to see if it can get the chatbot to do funny things or provide a guardrail around. There are startups that provide a guardrail around that wrap the chatbot. So it stays in its lane and doesn't start like hallucinating and doing all kinds of crazy things. So I think we have to think about security in a fairly holistic way, you know, from an engineering perspective as well as an end user perspective all the way, you know, to have some sense of assurance that you're trying to do the right things, you're deploying the right things. The security game, Sanjay, is really one-upmanship. If somebody tells you that they're very secure, that means they don't know what the hell they're talking about. Because, you know, you may be secure now, you know, or as of now, and that's it. Because you look at all of the threat vectors that are coming out, that are created by AI, it's a very dangerous world out there, especially with nation state actors and all of the activities that we see that are going on every day. You know, so I think it's something that's going to remain front and center, and it's going to be an active conversation that we should probably spend more time talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. So stay constantly vigilant is, I think, what your message is. Now, you look at data from a security standpoint. How about bias detection? Is that something that, and talk to our listeners a little bit about that, because that's, you know, you talked about the EU AI Act, the executive order in the US. But more than that, when I talk to CEOs, chief AI officers, most Fortune 500 companies now have ethics boards and stuff like that. Tell us a little bit about what your thoughts are and what your company is doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Our focus when we build a model is around the data and the source of the data. And I think any bias that you introduce, you know, there may be many reasons, but I think one of the big contributing factors is where the data is from and what the data says. And ultimately, you know, any bias that's surfaced in how the model makes decisions, ultimately, a lot of this is classification. You know, you're classifying something a specific way, and biases are caused by, you know, how the model is trained. I'm not saying that's the only source of bias, but I think the data that's used in the training process, you know, while the model is being trained, is probably one of the biggest contributing factors to any biases that are only realized in black box testing later on. I mean, you've got a specific, you know, set of use cases around bias testing that happen later on. But in our view, we shift left. We take those test cases and we move them left to much earlier or as early in the AI model lifecycle as we can. So we catch bias as early as we can. But I think it's kind of a disaster if you have a chatbot, you know, that's out there that you have shipped that displays obvious biases. I mean, it could become a public relations nightmare for your company, you know, and it's something you need to watch out, especially for public-facing bots, you know?
Yeah. And it has been a PR nightmare for some companies, which we all know. So since we've talked about bias security, tell our listeners your thoughts on the use of synthetic data. What do you think of that?
You know, this is very interesting. I'm a mentor and a co-founder in a company, a passive co-founder in a company called Vranix. It's a medical company. Mm-hmm. You know, we do monitoring and virtual care management, which is a huge problem in our aging population today. You know, because you don't have, you know, the number of healthcare professionals you need, and you have to leverage AI in healthcare. It's I think a very important use case. You've got classes of models where data is sparse. You don't have much data to train with. And I think the field of synthetic data generation has come a really long way. You know, if I can come up with models that are able to effectively synthesize data to train models from, you know, I think it's of huge value, and I think it's a very valuable IP by itself. But this is in fact what's tied to the bias conversation, because if you're not extremely careful that the synthetic data is properly representative, you know, and does not have any built-in biases, you know, then you're going to end up in a worse spot, because any models that you build from this data, you know, could in fact introduce the very biases that you didn't want in the first place. So I think there is a lot of promise with synthetic data generation. And I think you're going to have many different fields, including in healthcare, where I think synthetic data generation is going to be very valuable. But the mathematical techniques that you use to generate this data have to be sound. You know, they have to ensure that they reflect reality. You know, and I think you've got some theory and some math theory around that. Some of the founders in Vranix are experts in that area, but I think it's a separate, very important field all by itself, because you're never going to be at a spot, especially if you're a startup, to get access even to data, you know, and you have to figure out ways of synthetically, you know, generating this data. But then when you test a model built on that, you have to actually produce results that are as good as a model that was not trained on synthetically generated data, you know? So it's a very exciting field.
Yeah, it is. And one of the questions from your peers was for you was, Wilson, how do you prevent biases in synthetic data?
Yes.
Is that possible?
I think it's a field that has a long way to go. A field that I think is still evolving. And there's been some published research on this. I'll try to find some of those links and I'll send it to you. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Great question.
It's a very exciting area. Shriram, one of the things, as I said, our mission is to democratize AI talent. So there are a lot of people who listen to this show who are, you know, AI experts, and our mission is that they don't all end up with the four or five big foundation companies, the hyperscalers. They go to amazing companies like Exela. So tell those listeners, what do you look for in when you look to bring somebody on, and why should they join Exela? This is your moment, Shriram.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you for that opportunity, Sanjay. I think for me, attitude trumps many things, you know, not everything, but many things. I think, you know, we look for people who are passionate, you know, who have the right attitude, are willing to learn and grow, and who obviously have the right, you know, technological foundation. And especially in product and engineering, you want a culture where you have a team of people who are passionate, who are excited about what they do, and who want to make a difference, who want to do work that's meaningful. You know, and those are attributes that we look for all the time. You know, Sanjay, talent is hard. It's hard to come by. And it's not just about hiring the right talent. It's about incubating them, growing them, and keeping the talent long term. You know, and for me as a leader, I'm working very hard to eliminate my job. That's the ultimate sign of success. Have you built a team and an organization that can run when you're gone? You know, and it's a key attribute for every leader in my team. You know, I tell them exactly the same thing. And I strive to do that. And the people that you hire who are capable of growing and who think in that way is what allows us to build fantastic organizations, you know, that are self-sustaining and that don't depend on any one person. So those are some of the attributes we look for. But I really appreciate the opportunity, Sanjay. Yeah.
Well, I think you said some very interesting things. You said attitude matters the most. And for our listeners, please keep that in mind. And I've talked to maybe over 100 people. You're the first one who said, I'm looking to figure out ways to eliminate my job, which is pretty interesting ways. And he's looking for others who look to do the same. So, you know, you might get a chance to become the global CTO for Exela if you join Shriram, but you know, that's fantastic, Shriram. So Shriram, finally, we do a lightning round, which is basically a rapid fire one word answer questions for our listeners who have, who are TikTok consumers. So are you ready for that?
Absolutely.
Okay, let's go. Shriram, cloud or on-prem?
Cloud.
Python or R?
Python.
Supervised or unsupervised learning?
Unsupervised.
Okay, data lakes or data warehouses?
Data lakes.
Open source or proprietary?
Open source.
Okay. In-house AI development or partnerships?
Partnerships.
Okay, let me see. Transformers or CNNs?
Transformers.
Okay. Single or multi-cloud?
Multi-cloud.
Okay. AI agents or RPA?
AI agents.
Okay. What is the greatest AI challenge, Shriram?
I think it's security and privacy.
Security and privacy, okay.
Yeah.
Is Gen AI hype or reality?
It's hype. It's becoming reality.
Fantastic. Hype is becoming reality. Awesome. Before we wrap up, Shriram, what's one piece of actionable advice you'd give to organizations and your peers who are just starting this AI transformation journey?
Well, that's a fantastic question. I would say start small. You know, I would say focus on the lowest hanging fruit, which many people have already done, and get help. You know, don't try to solve it yourself. Get help.
Great. Start small, go for the lowest hanging fruit and get help. I think that those are incredible insights. So that wraps up our conversation with Sriram, Global CTO of Exela Technologies. Your insights on everything from private LLMs to security to responsible AI development, you know, they offer such valuable guidance for organizations who are navigating their AI journey, Sriram, but also for people who are looking to break into AI and their path, and small businesses with your, you know, vision of this customer support bot. So thank you really for your time, Sriram, and thank you to our listeners for joining us. Don't forget to subscribe to the CIO podcast for more conversations with leaders like Sriram, who are shaping the future of enterprise AI. And until next time, thank you so much, Sriram.
Thank you for the opportunity, Sanjay. This was fantastic. I really look forward to us continuing to talk. So it's been very, very, very fantastic. Thank you.
I learned a lot. Thank you so much.